April 18th, 2014. It's the Drupalize Me podcast. Drupalize Me. Okay, welcome everybody. I'm Kyle Hoffmeyer. I'm your host this week. It's been a while since I've hosted a Drupalize Me podcast. Addie is on vacation. We allow her to take those every once in a while since she works pretty hard. But what she's done here, she's tossed me a podcast that on a subject that I am not the most familiar with, so we decided to bring in some experts to help us out. What we're going to be talking about is most of us are familiar with Drupal hosting, and most of us do all of our stuff locally. Well, we hope we most of it do it locally at first. And then we somehow do some magic, you know, pushes and pulls and FTPs and other clever mechanisms to get our websites to a single machine called a server. But this podcast is going to uncover the mystery of hosting Drupal in the cloud. And I could sit here and talk about Nimbuses and Stratuses and all those types of clouds, but I have no idea what it means to host Drupal in the cloud. So with me, I actually brought Josh Koenig, the co-founder and head of developer experience at Pantheon. How you doing, Josh?
Great. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing great. I appreciate you coming. You can find him at getpantheon.com. So Pantheon is obviously Drupal hosting in the cloud and some other stuff that we'll bring up. We don't want to spoil everything right now. And then we also have with us Andrew Berry, the senior Drupal architect at Lullabot. How you doing, Andrew?
Pretty good. How are you, Kyle? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing great. We brought Andrew along because he does a lot of this at Lullabot. We work with a lot of clients, and obviously a lot of clients want to host their Drupal websites in the cloud. So why not bring another expert on board? So let's start. I'm going to actually just jump into some news and some events. So let's just go ahead and get those out of the way. This week in Drupalize Me, we continued on with our Vagrant series that will also be finishing up next week. So if you're into working with Vagrant and getting yourself up with some cool virtual machine technologies, go ahead and check that out. Coming soon on Drupalize Me, we're going to be having a series on mapping with Leaflet. And then soon after that, context and bean modules. So keep an eye out for some new series. We got lots of videos in the works at Drupalize Me. Also in the news, DrupalCon Austin schedule is live. So go check that out if you want to figure out what you're going to be doing when you head on over to Austin for the next DrupalCon. And in the events, there's a lot of camps going on, a lot of meetups going on. Go ahead and check out drupical.com. That's drupical.com just to see if there's any events happening near you. Also, if you have some time, please listen to our other Lullabot podcasts. We have Insert Content Here with Jeff Eaton and The Creative Process with Jaron Ponchat and Jeff Robbins. All right, let's get this going. Everybody, I mean, there's so many ways that we can deal with hosting our Drupal websites. I personally don't use the cloud because most of my stuff is just not needed, but there are some large websites out there. Let's just get some, I mean, MSNBC.com, thewhitehouse.gov. These are some websites that garnish a lot of traffic and need to basically keep running. And a server, a single machine is most likely not going to handle that. And also, we want to make so things are scalable and all this other stuff that these guys, these experts here are going to talk about. So I'm just going to toss out the first question and let's figure this out because not everyone understands exactly what the cloud is. It's one of those words that a lot of people have a different definition for, and it does have a pretty broad sense. So let's figure that out. What does it mean when we say the cloud? What's the actual infrastructure involved in creating a cloud for hosting Drupal?
Well, I can take a stab at that, Kyle. I think it's actually like it's really hard for anyone to really come up with a good definition for it because the marketing world has really sort of taken over the word the cloud, just like how, you know, a couple of years ago Web 2.0 was all the rage and everyone wanted to turn their websites into something that used Web 2.0 technologies, but it meant anything and everything, which meant it often meant nothing or very little in terms of actually communicating what was available or how the systems worked. But I think from a very, very high, super broad level, we can look at the cloud as sort of an evolution of hosting architectures from a hosting system where you intimately as a client know the hardware and the configuration of how it's set up. And what I mean by that is it used to be if you wanted to host a website of any kind, you would basically choose between shared and dedicated hosting. And the plans would be based off of what the physical hardware on the machines were. And if you were going to an ISP or a hosting provider, there was one specific machine that you had access to, and all those IP addresses and host names and so on could, you know, map to one single box that if you could actually get access to the data center, you could go in and touch and take a look at. And over the past 5 to 10 years, we've slowly seen this transition away from thinking about hosting as, you know, hardwares and servers and purchasing those out specifically and installing operating systems, to that part of the infrastructure basically being handled for you. You don't really think in terms of those metrics anymore. You're just looking at what can I get out of it. And so often when you're looking at cloud hosting providers, they don't even tell you what kind of, you know, CPU you have. They might say it's, you know, this class of CPU with about this much memory, and we're using, you know, SSDs or not SSDs, but they're not going to tell you the specifics of all the hardware involved. And when it comes down to it, it doesn't really matter anymore, because you just know that you've got something that's about what you're looking for, and it gives the hosting provider a lot of flexibility to change the underlying hardware without you having to change your application or your own hosting architecture. So, I mean, there's all kinds of services out there offering what they call cloud hosting, ranging from, you know, almost very similar to the old dedicated model of something like Linode, where you're buying a single virtual server at a time, and you have access to that, and it can maybe change what the physical box is on it without you knowing, but it's still, you know, one sort of unit in terms of a server, all the way through to other services where they're more talking in terms of really abstract levels like page views and total disk space and bandwidth and so on. And it's up to the hosting company to figure out how they provide that to you. So, yeah, it's a bit of a complex answer, but I imagine that Josh has got a really interesting take on it, given that he's been deeply involved in, you know, setting up a cloud himself.
Yeah, I agree that the term has become so widely used in so many different contexts. I mean, it's also a term that people use when they talk about things for just your desktop, like Dropbox is your cloud for your photos, and that, you know, this is sort of there's an idea behind what a cloud is more broadly, which is kind of like, stop worrying about like where things are and stop worrying about how they're set up and start just using the value and take less personal responsibility for where something is. So again, the Dropbox or Gmail is another example. Gmail is like email in the cloud. And you know, there used to be a time when you would have to set up an email server and you would have to worry about your SMTP credentials and all these other things. And the Google's has provided this service that lets you not have to worry about that anymore, as long as you trust Google to handle it. I think that when it comes to the world of infrastructure, web infrastructure and servers, you know, the Amazon EC2 really sort of kicked the door down here in a very real way, not just with the idea of providing infrastructure as a service, which is kind of what you're talking about, like don't worry about what physical hardware it's on, just get your instance size. They provide that service directly, and a lot of people use that. A lot of people actually just build a product on top of that and resell it. I think more interestingly, what they did with that when it debuted, you know, in 2006, was they really radically democratized the ability for people interested in web infrastructure to play with much more complex configurations than they would ever be able to otherwise. Because in the old world, where you actually had to have somebody rack and stack hardware, it's expensive. It's really expensive to get started. A single dedicated server would be, you know, hundreds, even close to the thousands of dollars a month, and with lots of setup fees and lots of lag. And so you couldn't be a hobbyist sitting there on your own and say, hey, I wonder if I can set up an architecture that uses, you know, 25 actual servers to do something interesting, because that's like a, you know, $75,000 proposition to get off the ground. With EC2, where you can buy smaller instances and pay by the hour, that's like a 10 $10 experiment that you can run in one evening. And I think that what part of what we're seeing is while not everyone is building on Amazon directly, the fact that their model got out there really, really put the power to use complex and novel architectures in the hands of many, many, many developers. Whereas before, it had really been closely held within, you know, people who did operations for companies with, you know, the kinds of budgets where you could afford to do that sort of thing. And I think a lot of what we're seeing now that's bearing fruit in the world of the web has to do with innovations and patterns and best practices that have emerged as a result of that, you know, sort of that opportunity becoming broadly afforded to all of us, or those of us who can afford a, you know, an Amazon Web Services account. So kudos to them. I sort of think that when it comes to Drupal and websites, here at Pantheon, we call hosting the H word, because I think hosting in many ways denotes a very singular piece that is only part of the puzzle of what you need to actually have a successful website project, both to build, to develop, to launch, deploy, and run over time a good property. So you can certainly replace what might be, you know, in your legacy terminology, hosting, with a cloud solution. But I actually think, and our take on this is that really, if you're going to do that, you should do somewhat more. You should think about, how are you actually going to be, you know, deploying? That's part of what you should be getting from your cloud. How are things being managed and upgraded? That's part of what you should be getting from your cloud, right? You should be able to get a lot more value than just a place to stick your stuff. And I think that this becomes increasingly important when you talk about being able to test things before you deploy, when you talk about being able to, you know, how do you actually scale these things? Those are issues that you know, sort of doing a one-for-one EC2 for servers replacement doesn't really deliver as much value, because you've just shifted from a single instance, you know, maybe in some cases, like literally on-premise for people, somewhere in their office building or in their closet, there's a server that ran their website. If you just one-for-one replace that server with an EC2 instance, you know, you saved yourself the headache of having to worry about kicking the power cord, but you haven't gotten that much extra value on top of that. You know, you're still responsible for managing everything about the server. It's still one instance, so if it goes down, you still have problems, and you're still not prepared to scale beyond the limits of what a single server can give you. So I think that if we want to give the term cloud real, you know, put some real heft behind that and have that be meaningful, especially in the world of websites, in the world of Drupal, it has to mean something that helps you build your website so that it can run in the cloud. It has to be something that lets you test your website in the cloud, and it needs to be something that allows you to scale your website and maintain it over time without having to worry about things like kernel upgrades or the Heartbleed bug or, you know, any of these other lower level system administration concerns that often, you know, become a bottleneck for a project because the most senior developer is the only one who can take care of them. I think that for the websites, cloud means never having to say the word server, honestly.
That's an interesting take on that. That's pretty cool. So you brought up Drupal when it comes to cloud, since we're obviously on Drupal Eyes Me podcast. That's a good transition for us. Besides having all these other managed services that a cloud can offer, Drupal specifically, what becomes easier? Does it become harder in some aspects if you're going to, I don't want to say it now since it's a naughty word, if you're going to host in the cloud, specifically Drupal speaking, besides having some of these other advantages, because not everybody's going to offer those advantages, obviously some specific Drupal products, Pantheon being one of them, what does the cloud offer for Drupal in specific, and maybe what makes it harder or definitely what makes it easier? What are some of the advantages?
Well, I think one of the most obvious advantages is when you start decoupling hardware from the rest of your infrastructure, it allows you to scale horizontally certain tiers of your web stack really quickly, and you can also do so at a really efficient cost. It's really common for larger public-facing websites to, say, have a tier of, you know, web servers running Apache or Nginx or something like that, and a separate tier of Varnish servers doing front-end caching and so on. And Drupal 7 in particular works really well with that sort of infrastructure. And so, you know, some of our clients, they have very cyclical traffic cycles. They have small periods of the year where they get ridiculous, ridiculous amounts of traffic, like just totally mind-exploding numbers coming through. But they don't need anywhere near that those sorts of resources throughout the rest of the year. And so hosting on a virtualized or cloud architecture allows them to really easily and quickly scale out their web or their caching tiers just when they need it. And with a lot of the cloud orchestration tools that are out there, you can make that happen somewhat automatically, which is kind of neat. So that way, if you are, you know, even if you know that there are certain periods in the year when you must have greater capacity, if all of a sudden there is some big news event or something that hits your, you know, causes a lot of unexpected traffic to hit your website, it's at least possible to scale out and have that those processes kick off even before a person's been involved. And so I think those are the sorts of websites that really, really take advantage of cloud architecture and so on. And it's really neat to see sort of, you know, Drupal being a 10-plus-year-old product, still being able to take advantage of that.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot that Drupal can do to actually take more advantage of that from an architecture standpoint. And it's interesting because when you talk about distributing your application, that's a very different proposition than running it on, you know, what a local development environment or a single server or virtual machine where everything is resident inside the same operating system. And one thing that developers will notice the minute they go to a distributed environment is that certain things get slower, which is maybe not what they're expecting. And that is because when you need to actually make a network connection to do every MySQL query, even though that network connection is within the same data center on the same network switch, you know, hopefully, and it's very fast, there's still a very real time that takes to just to get the signal from the application environment from PHP to the database server. And so Drupal being the extensible system that it is, sometimes there's a large number of queries. Even if the individual queries, this is not like, oh, my query of depth from views. It's more the 200 queries that are very quick. But if you make every one of those 200 queries just 1 millisecond slower, suddenly you've added 200 milliseconds to your page render time. That's something that is a challenge when you go to a distributed system that often is a surprise for people. And it's one of the reasons why it's really important, in my opinion, to have a cloud solution to be more than just the production hosting. I think everything Andrew said is absolutely correct, right? You can totally, the scalability and the elasticity that you get with cloud infrastructure, the ability to horizontally scale without having to fax somebody something to get some new hardware provisioned, that's key for big organizations. I also think it's key for smaller websites too. And I think what's really key beyond that to take full advantage of this is you need tools that let you ensure that what you're developing works in that environment. Because it can be a rather rude awakening when you've spent lots of time developing on your laptop, and then you go and deploy to production, and suddenly you have to scramble because it's not performing the way you thought it would. That's a challenge. The other issue is just being able to deploy to a cloud. When you're talking about deploying to a distributed environment, you can't just drag some files with your FTP client. And I think one of the values that a cloud provider should provide in the modern era is that they not only provide you with a strong way to do that deployment that's bulletproof, they also should be providing you with version control and other tools so that you can use these sort of best-in-class processes while you're building your website. And that gets to my point about sort of hosting being the H word, that while at the very high end, lots of highly trafficked websites are taking advantage of cloud infrastructure for production, I think the real benefit of the cloud is for all websites. And it comes with being able to bring more better tools to provide better process to be able to deploy into these kinds of very elastic environments, because you never know when you're going to be successful. And if you can keep if the cost can be reasonable, there's no reason why every website shouldn't be able to be that successful if they get so lucky, if they are so ambitious. And I think that if the cloud can look at beyond just the production environment and say, no, we have great tools for you to develop, we have great tools for you to debug, we have great tools for you to test, we have great tools for you to deploy, that can kind of raise the game of most web developers. Because I know that oftentimes when you sort of set up to start a project, The timeline is never as long as you want it to be. It's always, the budget's never as big as it should be. And the first thing that gets sacrificed under those circumstances are some of these sort of infrastructural tools that are really more for the project to work itself, for the development process to work well. Obviously, you can't skimp on the production environment, but I've seen so many people who do skimp on just setting up a workflow. And so I think a good cloud provider should be providing, you know, the entire tool chain you need to take full advantage of that, not just for the production benefits, but for everything that gets you up to that point as well.
Yeah, I think you said something really interesting there when you were talking about, providing debugging tools and so on for websites which are hosted in the cloud. And, you mentioned the performance impact of having, different parts of your application running on different machines or virtual machines, which means that they're going over a network. I found with a lot of our clients that can also really complicate debugging of problems because let's say you've got Redis or Memcache set up to act as a caching layer for your Drupal entities like nodes and users and so on to make it load those a lot faster. If you have those installed on the same virtual machine or same operating system as the rest of everything else that's running, Apache or Nginx and MySQL and so on, you don't have to worry about the network connection between Apache and Redis or Apache and MySQL or Apache and Memcache breaking down. And you can sometimes run into issues where things only half break. And so right. Then it's not a case of, oh, I can't talk to the database. It's that, I'm losing 10% of the queries that go to my database or something like that. And so I really think it's really important for any sort of cloud hosting provider to not only have really quality internal tools so that they can be proactive and tell you about those things when they're wrong, but also to make it easy and possible for you to figure out those things too, or at least to understand that something's going on. If it's completely black boxed, then it basically means your cloud provider has to be perfect. And if we ever find one of those, well, then I'll be super excited, but I'll probably be 75 and long retired before that happens. So I think if a provider can offer those sorts of debugging tools all the way from sort of, if they're very application specific, like how Pantheon, has been traditionally very focused on Drupal, all the way through to the infrastructure itself, I think that can provide a lot of value to clients and website implementations.
Okay, now you guys have been mentioning a lot of terms, scaling, all those types of things. I want to kind of I want to bring this to maybe, I'm sure a lot of listeners understand some of the stuff you're talking about, but I want to also bring this back to the technologies that have come out recently. Maybe you mentioned Amazon. To a lot of people, Amazon sells books. So what has happened recently? Is it just the cost of computers have come down? What over the past several years has made cloud computing possible at all?
Well, really, really broadly speaking, I mean, it is sort of, all of the trends and, more, you can get more processing power and more memory and more disk for less money. And there's more broadband everywhere. And everything is kind of, it's the continued acceleration of our ability to do computing and then to distribute that computing over networks. I remember in the late 90s, Sun Microsystems, which was a big name then and now is no longer around, had this idea of they bet the whole business on the idea of the network computer, which was this whole cloud concept, and it did not work out at all. They were just way ahead of the curve. I think we've reached this point now where just the capabilities that exist and the broad distribution of these capabilities makes the whole thing feasible. Moreover, I think that there are, at the infrastructure level, you have Amazon with EC2, you have Rackspace, they're sort of the hosting 1.0 leader, and now they have cloud as well. You have Google getting into the game. You have IBM has a cloud solution. A lot of other players have these other cloud solutions where they're providing what people often call infrastructure as a service. And that's kind of the lowest common denominator of cloud, where you can replace what would normally be a server that you would have to manage with a virtual server that they will provide for you, usually through an API on demand. And that is the and that helps, you know, on in some ways it helps drive costs down because you can pay by the hour and so on and so forth. But, you know, ultimately these companies are doing this because they make a profit on it. So the truth is, once people get to scale, there's a weird tipping point you hit where you realize you're spending much more on your cloud than you would if you had, you know, actual servers somewhere, because there is kind of a tax that's there for that elasticity, because you're saying, I no longer have the responsibility for worrying about physical instances. You pay a premium for that if they're always on over time. But in terms of the technology that are there, it's really the things that have driven most of the cloud stuff so far are the virtualization technologies. So it's Xen, and KVM and the providers, people who are good at running data centers, ability to, you know, get more dense hardware in place and then use those technologies to slice up these really large big servers that, like, you know, one would be like $30,000 or $40,000 a month to rent the whole thing. They can slice that up into hundreds of instances and provide them on demand to customers.
And I think the key part there, which maybe listeners who aren't familiar with virtualization would be interested to realize, is that unlike other, you know, hosting paradigms, each slice on one of those really large $30,000 or $40,000 a month servers is completely isolated from other instances on that server. And so you might be sharing what you, the resources that you are paying for with, you know, hundreds of other clients of that cloud provider. But from a security perspective, it's usually very, very good. And, you know, it's I can't think of, you know, recent vulnerabilities where, you know, it was, you know, really easy to break out of your sandbox, so to speak, and look at other people's data, which is a big difference from a lot of sort of legacy hosting architectures where you did have to worry from a security perspective about who else could see your code in your database and so on.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting because if you think about the what is the true lowest common denominator in the H word, which is shared hosting. Shared hosting is kind of a cloud-ish proposition, right? It's sort of like, don't worry about the server. You just get this amount of bandwidth and this amount of disk space, and here's a control panel, and go nuts. But the problem with shared hosting is you have all these you have security concerns that are very real, which you don't really have with virtualization, and you have performance concerns because there is no real way to isolate resource utilization between tenants in a shared hosting environment, and the impetus is always for the hosting provider. You know, when you look at the people who are selling the $1 to $5 a month hosting, they're really packing them in there, and so it only takes one bad apple to ruin the performance experience for everybody on that whatever, you know, hardware they tend to be sharing. The thing about virtualization that really changes the game is the security isolation. You have your own operating system, so you can install whatever you want all the way down. You get root, right? You don't get root in shared hosting, and you get a pretty good resource isolation with virtualization. So you know that you have access to a certain amount of CPU. You know you have access to a certain amount of memory, and in theory, you have access to a certain amount of disk. Although disk performance is always challenging.
Now, Josh, you've mentioned several times different like aspects of the cloud. A company should be offering this or that. Not all of them do. These are different things that you get, different parts of it. I remember back when I would choose what I wanted. It was like, oh, I'm going to pay more money here because this company offers 99% uptime, which always cracked me up because who's going to say we offer 95%? So it's things like that. What makes one cloud offering better than the other? And this is my chance for Josh to give his Pantheon pitch as well.
Well, so I think if you're looking at cloud offerings, always try before you buy. If somebody tells you that you can get their cloud, but you have to pay a bunch of money up front, they're not actually selling you a cloud, right? That means that they have a cloud. They're using the term cloud to explain what their service is, but really, in order to deliver it, they have to do a bunch of stuff behind the scenes and get a whole bunch of things ready for you so that they can manage the service for you. And you see a lot of things that are really actually just managed hosting, but you can't sell managed hosting now because it's no longer attractive. People know that that's the old world. So all managed hosting providers are now calling themselves some variety of cloud. And the way you can tell is, can I get access to that right now for free? And if the answer is not a generally yes, then you should be suspicious. You still might want managed hosting. There's actually plenty of value there for customers. But don't be that's sort of this term that we call cloud washing, where you sort of like greenwashing. You just do some stuff around the edges. You do some marketing. You say you're using Amazon or you use Amazon, and then suddenly you're a cloud provider. That's, I think, not really honestly the case. So, you know, again, if you want to use EC2 directly, you can do that immediately. And it's not actually, there is some stuff you can get for free, but it's not worth it. But it's so cheap, right? If you just, you can spin up the biggest, most badass instance on Amazon and kick the tires and play with it for a day, and it'll cost you like $8. And that's the kind of value proposition that cloud provides. I would look at, you know, what you're getting in terms of a tool chain, you know, if you're getting a complete tool chain or whether you're just getting production environment or just getting development. There are people that are doing cloud services just for development now too, which is interesting. So you should be aware of how much of your problem you're solving. Cloud is not just, you know, your scalable production environment. In theory, cloud should be something that really removes pain and friction from as much of your process as possible. So that's something to look at. And yeah, definitely check out, you know, if companies have SLAs, that's an important thing, especially for higher end customers. They're going to want a contractually backed SLA. That's a big thing with SLAs. Like, some people will say, we have this much uptime. The question is always, well, what happens if you don't, and what are the caveats around that uptime? I recently saw somebody who had a contract that floated across my inbox, and it was like 99.99% uptime, 4 nines. That's really good. That's like just a few minutes of downtime a month. But there was no actual consequence unless there was an hour. So it was like 99% uptime, 99.99% uptime, except there's nothing that will happen until we get down to about like 99.92. which is a really big difference. So there's a lot of ways that people kind of play games with their SLAs. And so what you want to know is, what's the actual uptime that's contractually backed, and what happens if that uptime guarantee is not met? And that's how you know how serious a provider is about backing that, you know, number up with their results. For Pantheon, so since you asked, and I will happily give our little pitch. I think that the benefit that we had, so we're actually very different from anybody else that's out there, in that we don't use virtualization to provide our service to our customers. We're not just turning over EC2 instances for people. We have like 60,000 and growing, several, like 1,000 a week get added, sites, and they all have the three environments. There's a whole dev test live sort of tool chain in there. So that would be 60,000 times three, you know, 180, so we'd be going on 200,000 EC2 instances if we were just doing this with Amazon. And that would be, a huge amount of money, and even though we're venture-backed, we're not that venture-backed, and B, an enormous challenge from an organizational standpoint. And get into the fact that, you know, our bigger customers are using a lot, so they would need a lot more. We actually use containerization, which is a newer technology that I won't dive too deep into because it's more of a kernel level thing. But basically, containerization is a much more efficient way to do a subset of what virtualization does, and it allows us to be much, much more agile and nimble with our infrastructure. So virtual machines, you know, if you request one from EC2 and it's got an image that goes to like your Ubuntu start state, that can take 5 minutes, sometimes even 15 minutes to really boot up. A container will boot in 5 to 15 seconds. And so that gives us the ability to provide a very different experience in using the cloud. So what we can do is actually give you the distributed environment for every instance of your site, so the distributed architecture for every environment of your site. So when you're working in your development environment, or you're looking at your development environment after you've pushed things up from your laptop, you have the same performance characteristics as you will in production. And if we need to scale you out in production, we're just adding more of the same containers. And so it's a very smooth process. There's no point in the process of scaling from a simple free sandbox site up to a site that does hundreds of millions of page views a month, where the architecture goes through some kind of radical change and unexpected things will happen. So when you first set a site up on Pantheon, you may feel some of the pain of the network connection being there for the database. Usually it's not that bad, and we do a lot of other things in terms of tuning and caching and making things speedy so that on balance it's usually a win. But you know that performance is exactly what you're going to get in your testing environment, and it's exactly what you're going to get in your live environment. And that's a promise that no other provider that I'm aware of can make, and I think that kind of makes us unique. Plus the dashboard, we think our dashboard is cool, and we're really developer-focused and very Drupal-focused. Again, those are kind of unique things for us as opposed to looking at just EC2 or something else.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, I think one of the other really big comparisons between different hosting providers is how much into your specific business operations they're willing to get into. And what I mean by that is something like EC2, they basically handle all the infrastructure around your EC2 instances. But once you get inside of that Ubuntu or CentOS or even a Windows image, they're not really dealing with that. It's up to you and your team to manage everything inside of those. And that gives you a lot of power, a lot of flexibility. If you want to set up a server that hosts a Drupal website, and I should probably not use the word server, but meh. If you want to host your Drupal website, but then you also need to run something from Node.js, and maybe you've got this mailing software you want to run for a mailing list, or things which are just totally different, you can do that with something like EC2 because you've got root. It's a box, and it's up to you to figure out how you're going to scale that out amongst different EC2 instances. But with great power comes great responsibility, and it's then up to you to manage all of the security and maintenance and access control and updates and so on those machines. And so different providers have tried to find different niches along the spectrum, all the way from basically, here's a bunch of resources, go have fun, through to, we actually know what Drupal is, but we'll give you, we maybe are Apache and web hosting and PHP experts, but they know what Drupal is, but they don't know a lot about Drupal, through to companies who will actually try and sort of work with your specific Drupal site, where if something isn't working right, they're willing to dive into your code, your custom code. And you pay different rates for all of those different services, but I think it's really important before you start signing contracts with companies to figure out where you want that demarcation point to be. And in some cases, that might be totally hosted. Like, you don't even run your website, you're using some hosted platform, but it could be all the way through to you do everything yourself. And figuring that out, it tends to be a lot harder of a question to answer for many clients than they realize when they start doing it. But then when they get through all the research, it turns out to be a really worthwhile exercise.
Now, one question in my mind is, with all this and everything, when it comes to Drupal, is there something specific that you have to do for Drupal to put Drupal in the cloud? In my mind, it's like, oh, I install the cloud module. But in reality, what are the challenges of using Drupal itself in a cloud environment?
So the biggest challenge that it's talked about a lot in the infrastructure circles, but sometimes surprises people when they come to it from a Drupal perspective, is the file system. Where your aggregated CSS lives, where your uploaded images live, when suddenly you're not actually sharing the same disk with everything, this becomes a big challenge. And it's because network file systems are a pain to run. And databases have been built since time immemorial to be shared over a network, right? That's the idea behind a database server instance, is that it has a lot of different clients that connect to it. That's like what it's built to do. File systems were designed to be, resident in one system. And so for Drupal to work, it's not something you necessarily have to change in Drupal, although you should be aware of it in Drupal. It's something you have to figure out in your infrastructure, is how to share the site's default files or wherever you have your files living, how to share that among all the different instances of your application. It's a big challenge. And we actually wrote our own file system at Pantheon to solve that challenge. But it's a tough nut to crack. And you will find that there are Drupal modules that are out there that aren't cloud friendly, I would say, because they really make intensive use of that file system, or they try to use it for temporary caching and other things like that. And those are things that don't work well on network attached storage. So that's the biggest single caveat, I would think, around putting Drupal in the cloud is the fact that most of the time Drupal is built to assume that it has a local file system. And when that's no longer the case, there can be unexpected results.
Yeah, I think one of the big issues I've seen with clients I've worked with is, I mean, for the most part, if you look at the really large individual files like videos, those are all being hosted or managed by some external service. They're, you know, using something like YouTube or one of the, you know, private competitors where they've got their own video libraries set up. And so it's pretty standard to have those live outside of your core website files directory. But then you start getting into image hosting, which on the flip side, almost all Drupal websites are still managing themselves internally. And part of that is due to the way Drupal works. Something like image styles, which is a feature in Drupal, which lets you resize and crop and convert and change images automatically, really assumes that it's dealing with files on the local file system. And once you start changing that, you can run into some really entertaining edge cases. And it really depends on how big your content store is. If you're talking about, you know, hundreds or thousands of images, especially over months or years, you know, even with the performance hits you might have with cloud file systems, it's not going to really matter because you just don't have the traffic to make it a big deal. But once you start dealing with, you know, tens or hundreds or terabytes of images, you really start to run into that. And then, I mean, I do think that while, you know, database connections are, you know, have been built to work over a network forever and ever, I still think one of the things you see with a lot of other non-Drupal systems is that they really try to minimize their dependence on a centralized relational database. Because it makes it a lot easier when you just sort of say, we're not going to try to solve the shared content store problem. You know, something like Dropbox, you look at how many, you know, thousands or millions of terabytes of files they must have in their system, but what files I have uploaded in my Dropbox have very little connection to other files in my Dropbox or files uploaded by other people. You know, you're not doing complex queries on those files or looking internally or anything like that. So they can very easily scale out that file storage. With Drupal, we actually, like, it's relations in our content that drive the value of most of our websites. And so we can't just say we're going to skip out on that problem, which for a lot of websites that have, you know, very large content stores, it can start to require a lot of hard thinking to work through.
Very cool, very cool. Well, we're getting close on this one. We're coming up on the almost the 45-minute mark. This has been very, very interesting. So I want to get a good final question in there, and that's what's coming for the cloud in the next few years. What's on the next big horizon?
Well, so for my part, I think I mentioned that Pantheon is built using this containerization technology, and the one thing is that is definitely the new hotness. We were a little ahead of the curve on that, but there are a lot of projects now that are making it possible for people to use that in lots of different contexts and do development with it. So if you're more of a command line aficionado and you like to tinker with services, you're one of those people for whom, like what I was talking about before, the democratization of, you know, systems architecture that EC2 brought, you know, sort of get on the container train because it's going to be really big. If you're interested in deploying applications, containers are actually a much better fit for deploying applications than full virtual machines are. I think that's going to be really exciting. The other thing, as I mentioned, more and more people are doing more and more interesting things with taking development work to the cloud. And it's still early days, but I really think that the potential there for being able to do collaborative development and being able to work, you know, to really improve the way that we work together on websites and on software projects in general is going to be as much of a game changer as the production hosting stuff going to the cloud was. So the development and testing, which is a little bit further along, I would say, it's kind of moving its way backwards. Like, the cloud really changed how most people think of the production environment, it's changing the ideas around testing and continuous integration. And I think it's going to have the same effect on development, which is going to be pretty cool, because I think it's going to make the lives of people who build websites for a living a lot more exciting and a lot more interesting, you know, in the next, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I think you're right on there, Josh. And I mean, I think just as you're talking about like the development of cloud development tools, whether that's something like a cloud IDE for doing your actual coding in, all the way through to doing your testing and your QA and your client acceptance and so on. I think right now what we've been seeing is everything pushing up from, you know, physical machines or local machines in your office on your desk for development and testing up to the cloud. I think we're going to start to see the cloud push its borders back into our offices, where even though we're talking right now about sort of the advantages of shared development and so on, you know, cloud infrastructure, I think we're also going to get to the point where as a Drupal developer, you're not necessarily setting up something special on your own machine just for development. Like MAMP is a great example. It works really well. It doesn't match any production web servers that are out there. Like, there's no one who's listening to this who's actually hosting, you know, on the cloud with OS X server using MAMP. You know, that would just, I mean, and if you are, please, you know, let someone know and they can help you move to something much better. But I think we're going to see over the next few years all of these tools that we're building for hosting our production websites, moving to developing our websites in the cloud, but then all those tools being available on our local machines as well, so that when we're doing development, we literally have a copy of, you know, whatever our cloud environment is running and ready to go. So that way we're not dealing with the deployment headaches that we sometimes do today.
Well, very cool. Very, very cool. I'm glad to, like I said when this started, I can talk about clouds in the sky, but I'm glad that we had this podcast. It was a very good idea to start learning exactly how we can get our Drupal sites in the cloud. I'd like to thank you, Josh and Andrew, for joining us today.
And hey, thanks.
That's great.
Thank you very much, guys. And if anyone has any questions or want to post some comments, please do that in the on the comments section there. And if you want to get a hold of us and maybe recommend the next podcast or give us some ideas or things you want to hear about, we're on Twitter, Drupalize Me, Facebook, Drupalize Me, pretty much everywhere. And also contact at drupalize.me. Please send us a note. Let us know what you want to hear about. And until next time, keep on Drupaling.